Nearly a decade after California's legislature and voters shot down a right-to-die bill and measure, two Democratic senators have introduced another bill that would allow California doctors to prescribe life-ending medication. The renewed push for legislation comes after 29-year-old Brittany Maynard moved to Oregon, where she legally ended her life on November 1st. She was diagnosed with a fatal brain tumor and ended her life after she said the pain became too painful to bear. Proponents of the right-to-die bill say we should have the right to die with dignity. Opponents say people with disabilities and the elderly could be coerced into ending their lives. So where do you stand? Join us after the news.
BBC News with Tom Sanders. More details have emerged of the helicopter crash in Argentina, which killed eight French nationals, including three prominent sports personalities. The Argentine pilots, who are highly experienced, also died. Video of the collision shows two helicopters flying close to each other in clear conditions before one appears to fly into the other. Both then fall to the ground. The sports personalities were taking part in a reality TV programme. Lucy Williamson is in Paris.
France is sending two investigators and two aeronautical advisers to Argentina to help find out what went wrong. A separate inquiry has been opened by the Paris prosecutor, looking at whether there's evidence of involuntary manslaughter. Video of the disaster, which happened during filming for a reality television show, shows two helicopters colliding with each other, killing the three contestants, five production staff and two pilots on board.
Iraqi government forces, backed by Shia militias, have surrounded the city of Tikrit as they try to recapture it from Islamic State militants. The Tikrit offensive is the biggest government operation so far against the jihadists. Here's our Arab Affairs editor, Sebastian Usher.
The operation to recapture Tikrit was launched more than a week ago. Now, Iraqi forces seem poised to mount a full-scale attack to drive IS out of the city. The capture of the next-door town of Alam appears complete, serving as a springboard for the assault. Victory in Tikrit would be a major propaganda boost for the Iraqi government, but it will be a test as well of the government's good faith and its ability to control the Shia militias that have been essential to the reinvigoration of the security forces. If there are major reprisals against local residents, it will seriously undermine the government's vital effort to win Sunni support in the war against IS.
A suicide bomber has attacked a market in the northern Nigerian city of Maiduguri. The security forces said at least five people were killed, including the bomber. The same market was targeted on Saturday, when nearly 60 people died in a series of suicide attacks in the city. These were blamed on the Islamist group Boko Haram, whose original headquarters were in Maiduguri. The British Foreign Secretary, Philip Hammond, says spying on Russia is being stepped up in response to what he called its aggressive behaviour and its intervention in Ukraine. Here's our diplomatic correspondent, James Robbins.
The Foreign Secretary was blunt. Russia, under President Putin, is bent on undermining the security of sovereign nations in Eastern Europe. And Russia's aggressive behaviour, he went on, was a stark reminder it had the potential to become the single greatest threat to Britain as well. Mr. Hammond made clear spying on Russia is being stepped up and that more Russian speakers are now being actively recruited by all three agencies, MI5, MI6 and GCHQ.
World News from the BBC. Ukraine has accused Russian-backed rebels of using the current truce to amass heavy weapons in Donbass, their stronghold in the east of the country. The military said the insurgents were transporting the weapons through the Debaltseve railway junction, which they overran last month despite the ceasefire. Both sides have also accused each other of several breaches of the truce. The authorities in Chad have closed all schools and universities following days of protests by students in which at least three people were killed. The students were demonstrating against a new regulation whereby all motorbike riders have to wear crash helmets. Our Africa editor Mary Harper reports.
Students have been killed, wounded and detained during the days of protest. The security forces have fired tear gas. A school bus has been set ablaze. All because the students and many others are angry about the new regulation. They say wearing crash helmets is intolerably hot in Chad's fierce climate and that they're too expensive. The price of helmets has tripled since the regulation was introduced at the beginning of this month. Like in so many African countries, motorbikes are a popular form of transport in Chad, where they're also used as taxis.
The World Health Organization says it has commissioned a panel of independent experts to assess its response to the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. Last year, the agency was strongly criticized for failing to act on early warnings about the scale of the epidemic. Almost 10,000 people have died during the current outbreak in Liberia, Sierra Leone and Guinea. And migrant workers in Dubai have held a rare demonstration against their working conditions. Hundreds of construction workers blocked main roads in the city centre as part of a pay dispute with their company. Riot police were deployed. They say they resolved the incident without violence or arrests. World News from the BBC.
Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In January, two California Democratic state senators introduced a right to die bill after the highly publicized death of Brittany Maynard. The 29-year-old Bay Area resident said she had no choice but to move to Oregon to legally end her life after she was diagnosed with a fatal brain tumor. She ended her life on November 1st, saying the pain was just too severe. Nearly a decade after similar legislation failed in California, the new bill would allow California doctors to prescribe life-ending medication. It would require two doctors to confirm that the patient is mentally competent and unlikely to live for more than 6 months. The medication must be self-administered. A written and two oral requests must be made at least 15 days apart, and two witnesses must attest to the request. California's bill is modeled after Oregon's 1997 law, with two differences. Pharmacists, not just doctors, will be given legal immunity for participating in deaths, and the bill requires a translator for non-English speakers. In 2008, Right to Die legislation was approved by Washington state voters, and court rulings in Montana and New Mexico allow terminally ill patients to end their lives. A total of 27 state bills have been introduced, according to Compassion and Choices. And just 3 weeks after state lawmakers introduced the Aid in Dying bill, cancer patients and doctors have sued the state of California on this issue. So as the debate about California's Right to Die bill continues once again, what do you want to know about this measure and where do you stand? Joining us today is Patricia Gonzalez-Portillo. She's Communication Director of Compassion and Choices. That's a nonprofit committed to helping people who have to have the best death possible. Compassion and Choices is the main group that supports this bill. Hi, Patricia. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. How are you? Thank you for having us here.
Good. Thank you for joining us. We're also joined by Marilyn Golden, Senior Policy Analyst with the Disability Rights and Education Defense Fund. That's a civil rights law and policy center directed by individuals with disabilities and parents who have children with disabilities. This group opposes the bill, saying people with disabilities and the elderly could be coerced into ending their lives. Hi, Marilyn. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Nice to have you. And we're joined by Dr. Stephanie Harmon, a specialist in palliative care and bioethics and end-of-life issues at Stanford University. And Dr. Harmon joins me in studio. Hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rose. Good to be here.
Great to have you. So, Patricia, I want to start off with you. I went over the bill, some of the rules in the bill. So, for example, it would require two doctors to confirm that the patient is mentally competent and unlikely to live for more than 6 months. Medication must be self-administered. Two witnesses must attest to a request that must be made at least 15 days apart. Is there anything else you want to add about what this bill would actually do?
Well, it would actually give the person that peace that they need to shorten their dying process painlessly and peacefully. For the past 17 years in Oregon, doctors have written over 1,000 prescriptions. Of those, 752 patients have used the medication to shorten their death, but only a small percentages have actually consumed the medication. Why? Well, just having the medication on hand gives them the peace of mind that they need so they can focus on living and not focus their last days on their dying. And we saw that again with, in the case of Brittany Menard, she was able to enjoy her last days with her family rather than focusing on, I'm dying, you know, this is the end. She was able to enjoy life at its fullest and enjoy, being next to her family on the time of her passing.
And you're working with Brittany Menard's family. The two Democratic senators who introduced this bill did it with Brittany Menard's family. Isn't it true that she actually prolonged her death? It was just based on the pain, right? I mean, in the stories that I read, she basically said, I'm going to die once the pain becomes too unbearable. And
yes,
that's why she did it on November 1st.
That is the beauty of the law. Because patients or Californians, people will actually, they're the ones who know how much pain they're suffering. And when the time comes and when they see that their pain is unbearable and that medication is not providing relief from the extreme pain, that's when they have the, in Oregon, unless we don't have it in California yet, that's when the person has the option to end their pain and suffering when the time comes, but only they're the ones who can know how much pain they're going through.
And Patricia, you know that this issue is very controversial. This bill actually died 10 years ago in California. Voters also shot it down. Why are you such a big proponent? Why are you dedicating your time to this issue?
Well, Brittany Menard basically opened the door and the conversation. Her experience of her and her family touched the heart of so many people, and it opened up this important conversation for many families in California and throughout the country. Her willingness to share her journey encouraged other families with a loved one facing the end stages of a terminal cancer to come forward, terminal illness, to come forward and say, you know, this is what we want in California or throughout the nation. And, we're seeking those options in California. The introduction of the bill came so much sooner than we expected because of the demand and the support from people from all over the country. And, again, I focus for California because that's where our campaign is at. And the stories we hear every day are just heartbreaking of people and their fears of where this type of illness could take them. And there is no need for that when they have the option to, you know, end their dying process. There's a difference between extending the dying process, and there's no need for people to go through where the illness will take them. We truly respect, I mean, there are many ways to die with dignity. We truly respect those who would make a different decision, but just to be in those situations, I mean, I lost my brother to cancer, and he was a physician, but just to have this option available so they can have peacefully when the time comes, I think no one should interfere with that, option to give this to Californians.
That is Patricia Gonzalez-Portillo. She's Communication Director with Compassion and Choices. This is the main group that supports the bill. Marilyn Golden is Senior Policy Analyst with the Disability Rights and Education Defense Fund. This group opposes the bill, saying people with disabilities and the elderly could be coerced into ending their lives. Marilyn, what are your main issues with this bill?
Well, the one you said, and quite a few others as well. If you only consider one individual's wishes or only the individuals who may want this, of course it looks from the outside like assisted suicide laws, it must be okay, but we might be okay. But we must step back and look broadly across society also at the many people who stand to be harmed. And that is something many people are not aware of, and we are trying to bring it out. The fact is, and I believe I can demonstrate why, that where assisted suicide is legal, some people's lives will be ended without their consent through mistakes and abuse. No safeguards have ever been enacted or even proposed that can prevent this outcome, which can never be undone. And here's a few reasons why. One is that there is a deadly mix when you combine our broken, profit-driven healthcare system with legalizing doctor-prescribed suicide, which would instantly become the cheapest treatment. Direct coercion is not even necessary. If insurers deny or even merely delay life-sustaining treatment, that's expensive, patients are steered towards hastening their deaths. Do we really think insurers will do the right thing or the cheap thing? And we have evidence of this occurring. Barbara Wagner and Randy Stroop, Oregonians with cancer, were both informed by the Oregon Health Plan that the plan wouldn't pay for their particular prescribed chemotherapy by their doctors, but would pay for, among other things, their assisted suicide. It's called a free choice, but for these patients, assisted suicide would have been a phony form of freedom. Similar thing happens to people with disabilities. We're often denied treatment and care that we need because our lives are undervalued or people think we might be better off dead. Let me also point out...
And Marilyn, just on that point, were the health insurance companies that blunt about it? I mean, did they say we're not going to fund the chemo or you need for your cancer, but we will fund the end-of-life prescription?
Among other things. This was the denial letter for the chemo, and they said the things they would fund, and one of them was the so-called death with dignity or assisted suicide.
So that's actually now health insurance companies in Oregon are actually telling patients that we will fund the death, whatever. What is it called in Oregon? I don't know the legal term for it.
This particular, let me just answer the thrust of your question, if I may. This particular insurer was the Oregon Health Plan. It was that state's Medicaid. And it's examples, it's exemplary of what can happen. I also want to point out that Oregon is largely white. California has a large Latino and black population where poor treatment is a far greater danger because of the documented health disparities that, particularly in our state and also in other states like ours. I hope you'll let me point out another major problem.
All right, but to that point, I think this is really important because I've read a lot on this issue and haven't read anywhere that Oregon, that the health provider you mentioned, is telling patients that we might not fund your chemo or we won't fund your chemo, but we will fund the prescription to die. What are your thoughts on that, Patricia? What about that major concern?
First of all, let me clarify that in the nearly two decades of... the Death with Dignity Act in Oregon, there has not been one incident of abuse. No one is being coerced. Those are some of the safeguards that are so important that people need to be aware of, because no one is giving a medication to someone who does not, first of all, qualify for it. And it, once the person qualifies, no one. The person must be fully competent to take the medication to self-ingest. Now, let me say one thing. I repeat, there has not been one incident of abuse in the Oregon 17-year experience. It has worked as intended, and the quality of life and end-of-life care, pain management, and use of hospice have greatly improved. The Oregonians are relieved of worries about future anxiety, pain, and control. And let me just say this. I repeat this. It's important to clarify that a person who does not wants to end their life has the option to live. These are terminally ill people who don't have the option to live. Their illness is they're dying from an incurable disease, and it's not something that is going to be coerced. Just to clarify, never has there been any reported cases of abuse in the nearly 20-year history of of the Oregon law.
Pat, what about the concerns, though? Because we all know that the health insurance industry is in the business of making profits, right? I mean, we've all seen our bills go up. What about what Marilyn just mentioned, that they're sending letters to people saying, we're not going to cover your chemo, but we will cover the medicine you need to die? What about that?
I don't know of that. That's not something that has come up to our attention. We support the work of people with disabilities to improve, you know, their health care. And it's also really important to know that people with disabilities are first of all, there are certain protections in the bill, right? And also, a majority of people in California who have disabilities, they support a law like Oregon's, including people with disabilities. We have more than 64% of Californians report that they support some kind of legislation like the one in Oregon. We've had support from people that we've never had before, from doctors, and you know, a lot of people with disabilities are most outspoken and powerful advocates and members of the disability community here in California and throughout the nation. So to call out numbers that say that, you know, we're ending the lives of people, it's going to be in the hands of the wrong people, that is absolutely false because it's never been reported, it's never happened.
Marilyn, where has this been documented? Because I didn't see any information about health insurance companies telling people that they weren't going to cover chemo, for example, but they would cover end-of-life medication. I just haven't seen that in any of the reporting.
First of all, the Oregon reports are very minimal and very skimpy. They don't show abuse because they have no mechanism to investigate abuse. The state is not authorized or required to report abuse, and it's not going to show up in the Oregon statistical reports. I can send you all kinds of articles.
But do we have a letter from a health insurance rep?
Yeah, because we have many news stories about Barbara Wagner and Randy Stroop, to whom this happened. I don't claim that it's still happening. We give it as an example of what can happen in these capitated healthcare systems. I appreciate you're trying to clear the record about that. I would like to be able, in the spirit of unbiased reporting, to give additional concerns that we have and not dwell solely on this one.
Well, I mean, I just want to clarify because it's such an important part of the story here. I did find a story from 2008, ABC News, saying that the 64-year-old Oregon woman whose lung cancer had been in remission learned the disease had returned. Her last hope was a $4,000 a month drug that her doctor prescribed, but the insurance company refused to pay.
That's right, and she got this letter. But may I go on to give other burning concerns that we have?
Sure. And the Oregon Health Plan, I'm just reading this while I'm talking to you, because it's a really important part of this story here. The Oregon Health Plan did agree to cover the drugs for physician-assisted death. Those drugs would cost $50 in comparison to the $4,000 a month drug that she wanted, the chemo. So I just think that's really important to get that out there. So
What we're trying to say, that these are examples that this can occur. So thank you for helping us document that in a real-time fashion.
Yeah, and just, you know, again, I repeat, we're basing our facts on the Department of Health from Oregon, and there's never been an incident of report abuse. An incident of abuse reported. So it's just important to clarify that as well.
And Pat, are you concerned, though, in a state like California? I mean, it's a massive state, and we're paying, I mean, my health insurance just went up another $30 a month. Are you concerned that if this bill passes, if I need chemo, for example, my health insurance provider might say, sorry, we're not going to pay for it, but we will provide the money for this prescription?
I'm sorry, but like I mentioned before, this has never happened before, and we're not going to go on any kind of speculation.
That is Patricia Gonzalez-Portillo. She's Communication Director with Compassion and Choices. This is the main group that supports the bill that was recently introduced. It's the Right to Die Bill in California. It was introduced by Senator Bill Monning, a Democrat in Carmel, and Senator Lois Walk, Democrat in Davis. And just to give you some time frames on this, it's SB 128. It'll be heard in a Senate Health Committee on March 25th. The public can comment at that time. The hearing will be at 1:30 at the State Capitol, Room 4203. We don't have an assembly bill yet, but we are expecting one. We're also joined by Marilyn Golden, senior policy analyst with the Disability Rights and Education Defense Fund. They oppose the bill, saying people with disabilities and the elderly could be coerced into ending their lives. And I want to bring you into the conversation, Dr. Stephanie Harmon, specialist in palliative care and bioethics and end-of-life issues at Stanford. This is becoming an explosive topic, Dr. Harmon, just because we've got 10,000 people turning 65 every day, and this country is woefully unprepared. We've done a bunch of shows on this in the last year. So what are your thoughts about, you know, not only this debate, but just what people are facing as they age and these really difficult decisions that they have to make?
Well, I think you're highlighting this much broader and larger issue that kind of houses the specific legislation. You know, we are looking at many, many folks who are going to be thinking about planning, and our clinicians are not trained to do so. And in the talking about this in the hospital or in the intensive care unit, when your loved one is not awake and unable to speak for themselves, is too late. And so we are looking at a sea change that we must enact in healthcare in order to get these conversations happening much further upstream. I think that we are all looking at this kind of tsunami, this wave of folks who are going to be older than 65, who are going to be thinking ahead. And, you know, in California, the California Healthcare Foundation had done a study they published in 2012 looking at, are Californians able to talk to their clinicians about their end-of-life wishes? And while the vast majority, 79%, said they would like to, only 7% had reported that that occurred. Wow. That is a huge gap. We have so much work to do.
We did a show about the Frontline documentary on this very issue, mm-hmm. and a few palliative care doctors said they're starting to work with your primary care physician, for example, to have that conversation, because a lot of doctors either don't know how to deal with it, or they basically promise you drugs that might work for another 3 years, even though deep down inside they know that that's not the case.
Right. And I think that that's key, that it's not just about having these discussions when you are very close to the end of life with a palliative care physician. It's about all clinicians having these basic skills and training to have these conversations earlier, and that that patients and families are informed early on so that they can make the best decisions for themselves. So,
and as we're seeing with someone like Brittany Mannard, it's not just older people. We're seeing a lot more cancer cases, life-threatening diseases with young people.
Yeah, I mean, we just actually spoke to a woman by the name of Christy O'Donnell, who is featured in People magazine. I believe the article is coming out this week, but it's already available online. Here's a 45-year-old woman who's an attorney, who is a former LAPD officer, who's dying, and you know, she fears not being able to hug her daughter. And she's upset that, you know, the law in California does not allow her daughter to, you know, why is she having to go through all this, that the law of California will not allow her to die peacefully with her daughter. And she's, you know, she's got lung cancer and brain cancer, and she was inspired by Brittany's story. And she's like, why is the state of California prohibiting me from dying the way that I want to? And those are really powerful stories that are just leading to other stories. People are calling us constantly, day and night, to let us know, how can I come forward? How can I help legislators listen to my story that I want this option in California? And like I mentioned before, if you don't want to take this option, it's okay. But just to have the option there, it gives them the peace of mind. It's very easy to
speak without being in a situation like this one. I mentioned earlier, my brother was a physician in Texas, and he became a patient himself. He was the director of a hospice center. He tried everything. I mean, we're Catholics. We said, he kept telling us, please stop praying for me. Don't want to keep me here. I am in pain. I don't want to suffer. And unfortunately, the law, you know, there is no such law in Texas, but just seeing him there, connected to all these machines, you know, where he can't even pick up a fork to feed himself. Here is this, you know, this brilliant doctor who everybody respected, heck, can't even, you know, go to the bathroom, can't even
And Pat, I really hate to cut you off there, but I have to go to break, and I'll ask you to continue telling that story right after the break. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
Lots of ways to join in on today's presentation of Your Call with Rose Aguilar. If you have a perspective that we haven't heard in today's discussion, or a question you feel should be answered, please join our conversation. It's a toll-free call, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Again, it's a toll-free call. If you prefer to write rather than call, the email address is feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11, World Have Your Say from the BBC, and at noon, Philosophy Talk.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we continue our series on police, community, race, and justice by talking about how citizen oversight boards of police departments work. There are many different models in Northern California, Oakland, Sausalito, Novato, Berkeley. What power do citizen oversight boards have to ensure police accountability? Where are these boards actually working? Thursday, we'll have a conversation about a new documentary called The Hunting Ground, which is about sexual assault on college campuses. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about a right-to-die bill in California. It was recently introduced by two California Democratic state senators. The bill would allow California doctors to prescribe life-ending medication. It would require two doctors to confirm that the patient is mentally competent and unlikely to live for more than 6 months. The medication must be self-administered. A written and two oral requests must be made at least 15 days apart, and two witnesses must attest to the request. So what questions do you have about this bill, and where do you stand on the right to die movement? We'd love to hear from you, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by Patricia Gonzalez-Portillo. She's Communications Director of Compassion and Choices, a nonprofit committed to helping people have the best death possible. It's the main group that supports the bill. Marilyn Golden, Senior Policy Analyst with the Disability Rights and Education Defense Fund. They say that people with disabilities and the elderly could be coerced into ending their lives, and that is one reason why they oppose the bill. Dr. Stephanie Harmon is a specialist in palliative care and bioethics in end-of-life issues at Stanford University. And Patricia, before the break, you were talking about your brother in Texas. I'm really sorry I interrupted, but I had to go to break.
No, I thank you for giving me the time to share his story. My brother was 58 years old. He was on top of the world, this career, and all of a sudden, he gets a kidney issue. He gets diagnosed with cancer, and then the cancer metastasizes to his brain. My brother was the director of a hospice center in South Texas, and as I mentioned, my brother begged us to stop praying for him because he didn't want to live, because he as a doctor, knew what was coming with the illness. My brother couldn't even hold a fork to feed himself. And it was so hard to see him because he was so proud of you know, being a doctor, and he could not, there was nothing science and medicine could do for him. Why did he have to be connected to machines and catheters? Why did, you know, he couldn't even feed himself. He couldn't even get up to go to the bathroom. And you know, he didn't want that. He was in so much pain. Why do we have to put people to go through that? If they could just have the option. We're not saying this is for all. If you don't want this option, you don't have to use it. But just having the option, I mean, can you listen to me? Can you listen to my brother saying, please stop praying for me? We're Catholics, and you know, all we wanted was to see my brother there, to say, oh yes, he's alive. And, you know, but how is his condition? He's connected to all these machines. He's got, I mean, he can't even get up to, you know, go to the bathroom. He can't even feed himself. He's losing, you know, he doesn't know who he is anymore. Why do we have to go to that? Why do we have to get there? And if there would be some kind of option, that there's no need for us to suffer when this legislation would give us the option to, you know, just take a medication, dilute it in orange juice, be surrounded by your family, by your music, by your photos, by your children, holding the your loved ones. Why can't we have this?
Marilyn, what about that case, the case of Patricia's brother and so many others like him?
Well, as we said earlier, when you look at the people that want it, it may look like it makes sense, and my heart goes out to them. But I really must say that assisted suicide endangers many other people, and I really hope you'll give me a few minutes to talk about, at least a little bit about those dangers. We talked about the dangers from the healthcare system. Let me go on
Marilyn, can I just ask you to comment directly about, like, Patricia's brother, for example, or Dori Maynard, who was 29 and had a fatal brain tumor? Brittany, what about their right to make these decisions?
Whenever we are considering public policy, we need to compare the benefits to the harms. Under the legalization of assisted suicide, there may be some benefits to some people. Even the proponents say it will be a small number. But there is such a risk of a huge harm to so many more people. And we've had a very difficult time getting the media to let us get the story out about why this is true. Whenever you debate public policy or consider public policy, you need to weigh the benefits and the harms. I'm not saying benefits are zero. I'm just saying I'm trying to get out the picture of what the harms are. And I've been able to say one thing about them, and I'd like to say one or two others, because people don't understand what the harms are. They know what the benefits would be. So I'd like to say something about, for example, elder abuse, which is a rising problem in every state in our country, and abuse of people with disabilities as well. And in talking about elder abuse, I want to respond to the your spokesperson from Compassion and Choices.
Patricia.
Patricia.
Yeah.
Says there have never been any abuses. The Oregon reports don't say that. But even though Compassion and Choices repeatedly says there have never been any abuses, there are many documented abuses, abuses of people with depression, abuses of people who had dementia, abuses of people who shop for other doctors. And a big issue here, and let me finish this point, and then I want to make one more, if you'll let me, at least that, and then is elder abuse. When assisted suicide is legal, it is a recipe for elder abuse, because an heir, that is someone who stands to inherit from the dying person, or should I say from the ill person, or an abusive caregiver, either one, is legally allowed to steer someone towards it, to witness their request. They may pick up the lethal dose for them, and in the end, they may even administer the drug. Because no witnesses, no objective witnesses, or any witnesses, are required at the death, so who would know? The other point that is critical for people to know, since much of the energy for the legalization of assisted suicide comes from fear about pain at the end of life, which I think our show so far is showing that that's the concern, Importantly, for anyone dying in discomfort that is not otherwise relievable, there is a solution today that's legal in every state in the United States. It's called palliative sedation, where the patient, if they're uncomfortable, can be sedated to the point where the comfort is relieved while the dying process takes place. So we already have a legal solution to any uncomfortable deaths that does not endanger others the way an assisted suicide law goes.
Dr. Harmon, do you want to jump in and comment on that?
Yes. I think the story around palliative sedation is the intent is then to relieve the pain, and the unconsciousness is the only way to achieve it. And there, it's fortunately not very common, but that does happen. And that is something that hospices, clinicians who specialize in this area can help families and patients.
How do you deal with that, though, when you're talking about a 29-year-old woman? How would that apply to someone like a Brittany Mannard?
I can mention
Dr. Harmon?
In terms of controlling pain?
Exactly.
Then it's really an informed discussion around, you know, how we can control your pain, meaning, but the risk, the trade-off is that you won't be awake. You know, that is, if we have tried other types of medications. So this is a solution that only comes when we haven't been able to achieve the balance that a patient or family member wants with regards to pain and being awake. And then we can bring this option in. It's an extreme option, but it is one that's there. Mm-hmm. And again, with the control and the intent of pain control being the tantamount thing, and that the unconsciousness just is in service to controlling pain.
Dr. Stephanie Harmon is a specialist in palliative care and bioethics and end-of-life issues at Stanford. Patricia Gonzalez-Portillo is communications director with Compassion and Choices. They support California's Right to Die bill, recently introduced. And Marilyn Golden is senior policy analyst with the Disability Rights and Education Defense Fund. They oppose the bill. One of the main concerns is that people with disabilities and the elderly could be coerced into ending their lives. And we have full lines. I want to make sure we get in as many people as we can. And I'm sorry it's taken a while to get to all of you, but I really wanted to get all of the information out there. So let's go to Ingrid in Berkeley. Hi, Ingrid.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. I'm a woman about 50 years old who lives with a degenerative neuromuscular disease, and I have for a long time. And I actually need help using the toilet and eating and breathing and doing all that stuff, and I use machines. And the thing is, I've always known, you know, that I could commit suicide if I wanted to. What I want to know is why Compassion and Choices is putting so much money and so much effort into assisted suicide rather than assisted living. Because this kind of bill really feeds stigma against people like me. And I want help living, not help dying.
Well, thank you for your question. I can certainly understand your points, but it's really important to clarify that we are not spending money in the, you mentioned the word assisted suicide. This is not suicide. These illnesses are already ending the life. Suicide is an act by someone who does not want to live, and people with who are terminally ill don't have that option to live. These people are dying, and they're dying soon. I repeat, this is only an option, and it's important to clarify that we do not support any type of suicide. Suicide is a person who does not want to live, and people who are seeking these options are people who are dying already, and they're dying soon. They want the option to die without the pain that the illness will take them to.
Pat, what are your thoughts on concerns of people with disabilities who say this does send a message that our lives are not worthy? Because a lot of people have lived for years, you know, needing help to do basic things. And for example, someone who's 50 or 60 years old all of a sudden gets in a car crash, something terrible happens, and they're in the same position but don't want to continue living.
Well, first of all, it's important to clarify that people who want this option or who access this option must be fully mentally competent, aware of the, you know, the option they're taking. They cannot be coerced. So if a person is in a coma or not able to make decisions for themselves, they would not qualify for this legislation. It's also important to know that people with disabilities are most some of Compassion and Choice's most outspoken and powerful advocates are members of the disability community. People with disabilities may also develop terminal illnesses, and medical aid and dying should be an option for those people, along with other options like palliative care and hospice. We support palliative care and hospice 100%, but when there is nothing that medicine can do to treat an illness, we would like to have this option available to them, because it's not something that there is absolutely nothing medicine can do for this person, and the person is going to die, so why not give them the option to make their suffering and their dying much shorter and lessen that dying process, like it did for Brittany. I mean, she did not want to black out, and she did not want those headaches that she was already experiencing. I speak to her husband on a regular basis, and he tells me that doctors told Brittany that, you know, basically the medication was not. Brittany said the medication wasn't doing anything for her. We have a story of a woman by the name of Anita Freeman, whose sister had all sorts of palliative care, and the medicine didn't touch her illness. The morphine was not doing anything, and the pain was just unbearable for her, and it caused her to suffer an agony of weeks. Same case for the case of a doctor, Robert Olvera, who's a Harvard physician and one of our supporters. His daughter, Emily Rose, was 25 years old. The medication that they were giving her, the palliative care, it wasn't working. So in all cases.
Dr. Harmon, does this concern you when you think about the message it sends to the disability rights community just about their lives? Because I've heard from a lot of people with disabilities who go through a lot of these challenges, and they say, well, what message does that send to our community?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think that the spirit of the law around giving control, I think that is important. My worry is that, again, there's so much attention and resources being poured into this one decision, this one point at the end of a person's life, that I think one of the things that was highlighted by Ingrid was around all the different healthcare issues we have for patients right. who live with chronic illness, serious illness, who are older, and that we don't have the kind of support services built into our healthcare system for those kinds of needs. It's a much, much greater issue.
Yeah, we have an email from many, many listeners about the insurance issue in Oregon. One listener says, mm-hmm. the example of the woman in Oregon who was denied coverage for her chemotherapy may be irrelevant. The important question is whether the chemo drug denied to the woman would have been covered before the Death with Dignity law was passed, and if that drug is currently covered by the same company in other states under the same circumstances where assisted suicide is not legal. Insurance company greed must be regulated regardless of the disease and treatment in question to have it confirmed that a health insurance company would rather their patients die than get treatment seems an incredible story, which would gather public pressure and bring about policy change. We're getting flooded with similar emails.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I think that that's a huge issue where we see bizarre kind of conflicting logic amongst kind of what's covered by insurance, where we'll have different interventions covered, whereas these kind of very straightforward, potentially social support services, additional home care, which won't be covered, but having people going back and forth into the hospital with things that could have been prevented with better home care isn't covered.
We have a nurse. Susie writes in, I've been a practitioner for 20 years. I would like to respond to this health insurance issue. Many health insurance companies do this all the time, especially if the drug is new or experimental. Please be careful in how you justify not endorsing this new very good law. People don't want to suffer and should have the right to decide when to end their lives. If you're worried about abuse, people should make sure they entrust their decisions to those they trust and will not benefit from their death. Thank you for that email, Susie. And let's go next to Maria in Berkeley. Hi, Maria. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks. Yeah, I just wanted to make a couple points. First, I'm an emergency physician, and I think that we're getting pretty biased views from both of the proponent and the opponent to the bill. No physician is going to force any patient, whether they're at the end of their life or not, to have tubes or catheters or anything that they or their family don't want, because that would be considered battery. So I think it's really important to make that very clear. I think also there's a lot of abuse that sort of happens on the other end, where there isn't any discussion about end-of-life care, and you end up with individuals like Dr. Harmon is saying, who haven't had that discussion and end up getting a lot of care that they most likely wouldn't have wanted at the very end of their lives. And I think that if hospice and palliative care are carried out in a way that they should be, I kind of question, I guess, what gap this bill would fill. And I would love, as an emergency physician who sees not enough of these discussions happening when they should, like before they come into the emergency department in extremis and we sort of have to do everything, I would love these discussions to happen earlier about end-of-life care.
Yeah,
you know, any comments? I can take any comments off the air.
Thank you so much, Maria. My grandfather passed recently, and in the will, he said, I do not want to be connected to any machines. And so he went to the hospital, no machines, and died peacefully. Now, maybe if he had the machines, he'd still be alive but not be able to function. So, Dr. Harmon, are you finding that more families are realizing that they need to make these decisions maybe years before their loved one passes away or might be on that path?
I do find that. I think people are really getting galvanized by what they're hearing about, even in the media, about a lot of stories like, you know, Atul Gawande, about Katie Butler's book, you know, and these stories, I think, are allowing folks and really motivating folks to think about these issues earlier down the line. We're just hitting the tip of the iceberg, though, because in our hospital, we still see patients day in, day out who come in and haven't had these discussions. And just like the physician on the line was saying, that they're having discussions far too late, in extremis, where no one wants to be making these decisions under such duress, or when people are, you know, so seriously ill that even their thinking, their clarity is compromised.
Well, thank you again for calling in, Maria. That is Dr. Stephanie Harmon, a specialist in palliative care at Stanford. Marilyn Golden opposes the Right to Die bill in California. She's with the Disability Rights and Education Defense Fund. And Patricia Gonzalez-Portillo supports the bill. She's with Compassion and Choices. This is the main group that supports the bill. And let's go next to Mike in San Francisco. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I'd just like to make one point and ask one question. I really want the audience to understand and be careful in now analyzing this. Who benefits the most from passage of such a law? It is the insurance companies. And I would like to address my question as to why the president of Compassion and Choices is from the insurance industry, and where do they get their money from to have all these fancy conferences and basically be able to support directors in almost every state? Where does that money come from?
All right. Well, thank you for calling in. Patricia is communications director there. Patricia, is your president from the insurance industry, Barbara Coombs Lee?
Yes. Our donations come from supporters and people who come, you know, from all over the country, or I'm specifically speaking for California, but yeah, from donors, people just who support our legislation.
And what did she do before heading the Compassion and Choices?
She is an attorney and a former nurse, both.
And so what would you say to people like Mike, who are concerned about these ties?
That we receive donations from insurance companies.
And believe that the health insurance industry is going to benefit from a law like this.
I'm not aware of anything like that. I'm sorry.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Mike. Let's go next. Actually, I have a number of emails. Carl says, thank you for the balanced show. I hate to be so crass and cynical, but what's the difference between assisted suicide and palliative sedation? Other than that, for palliative sedation, our dysfunctional healthcare system can keep you technically alive long enough to drain the bank account. Dr. Harmon, do you want to take that?
So, you know, I think that with palliative sedation, that the goal of palliative sedation is to relieve the pain and not go beyond that. And so while it's something that's enacted when all other measures to control pain and maintain someone's awareness and wakefulness, if they haven't worked, then we go to something like palliative sedation. The difference is between that and assisted suicide, that the intent of assisted suicide is to take medication to the point that you reach death, not just unconsciousness, and that we have some patients who are sedated and then you can actually pull back on some of the sedation and see if their pain has actually improved or been relieved. So the intents are very different. The goals are different between the two.
All right. Thank you for that. Monica writes in and says, I wonder what refinements, if any, would make this bill acceptable to the disability rights community. Marilyn?
There really aren't any, because there are so many dangers and so many problems. I haven't had the chance to explain them, but depressed people will be harmed. Michael Freeland, with a 43-year history of acute depression, received lethal drugs in Oregon. If the safeguards are so strong, how did that happen? There's the dangers of misdiagnosis. Doctors very frequently misdiagnose terminal illness. Sometimes they think it'll be too soon. Sometimes they think it'll be too late. The disability community is full of people who long survived a terminal diagnosis, sometimes by decades. And this is key because it shows how people with new disabilities or new chronic illnesses, and I have examples of people who I know that I could give, who may go through initial despondency and suicidal feelings, and if this is legal, may take that out. But under the current, such as in California today, go on, adapt to their disability. It's well documented that people adapt, statistically likely for people to have solid adaptation processes and go on to find value in our lives. But the adaptation period takes longer than the 15 days waiting period in the bill or in the Oregon model. And so before somebody learns the truth of how good their quality of life can be, it would be all too easy if doctor-prescribed suicide is legal to make the final choice one that is irrevocable. This happened to Dr. Richard Radke, a colleague of mine in Hawaii, who was very ill with muscular dystrophy, a very significant disability, for something like 30 years in the first 2 years of his life.
Marilyn, we've got about 10 seconds.
Oh, I was going to say that he would have taken this out, and he ended up fighting the bills after a long career and very happy family life.
And Patricia, we've got 30 seconds. Do you want to make your final case for this bill?
I'd like to thank you for inviting us to the show. And just a clear reminder that people who access this legislation must be fully mentally competent. It must have the diagnosis of two physicians. And it's important to know that there has never been any instance of abuse in Oregon's nearly two-decade history. It's an option for Californians. We hope to make this available so people don't have to leave their state when they are in such a critical part of an illness that is already chaotic for them to have to pick up their life, their doctors, and just leave their home.
Well, we'll have to do a show about what's happening in Oregon. Patricia Gonzalez-Portillo, Dr. Stephanie Harmon, and Marilyn Goldman, thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. How do citizen oversight boards of police departments work? On the next Your Call, we'll continue our series on police, community, race, and justice by discussing different models in Northern California. Oakland, Sausalito, Novato, and Berkeley have review boards, but few people know they exist. So what power do citizen oversight boards have to ensure police accountability, and how should these boards work? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Nock Nguyen produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.